Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So did you have your three square meals a day yesterday? We'll talk more about that on A Taste of the Past. And welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And, you know, Thanksgiving is right around the corner. Thanksgiving is, I think, everyone's fantasy of the ultimate meal with family, friends, all sitting around a bountiful table. And meals have pretty much come to represent just that, sitting around with family or friends around a table laden with food at designated times of the day. But, you know, it wasn't always like that, and I've come to find out quite a bit about it. Today, my guest is Abigail Carroll, and that's who I found out all about it from. She has written a new book called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Abigail is a food scholar and a historian, and in this book, she traces the history of the American meal, from trencher mess of the colonials to TV dinners of our, well, today and yesterday. Abigail, welcome.
Thank you, Linda.
Abigail, I did not, I have more to mention about Abigail, actually. She has taught in the gastronomy program at Boston University, and she's published articles in a variety of publications, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. She holds a PhD in American Studies from Boston University and makes her home in Vermont. That's where she's joining us today by phone. And Abigail, this book has just been fascinating to me. I mean, it's taken me back, and the images I see of, you know, of travelers, of colonists, of... You didn't really start out to write a book about this, though, did you?
No, I didn't. I actually wanted originally to write a book about the history of snacking in the United States. I was doing research for the Indiana State Museum on the relationship between snacking and obesity, and I wanted to find out whether we always snack. You know, obesity is, a newer phenomenon, so I wanted to know whether snacking was also a newer phenomenon. But I couldn't find any secondary sources that really looked in depth at this, so I thought, well, the book doesn't exist, and I will write it, and there was plenty in the historical record to draw from. But as I began to delve into the research, I realized that the birth of the modern snack is really wrapped up in the birth of the modern meal, and you can't tell one story without telling the other. They're really two sides of the same coin. So I ended up telling both.
Well, and I'm happy you did, because it has just opened my eyes to a lot of things. But you do also write in very vivid imagery style, which I like, and it is a pleasure to read. But let's start at the beginning. This is the American meal, after, and we have to remember that. We're not going back to the caveman. But it's almost so we do. The American meal. Bring us up to speed a little bit about where you start in your timeline, and like the early colonists' meal pattern.
Well, I begin with the European explorers and settlers and their encounter with Native Americans. And Native Americans were not known for eating fixed meals. They didn't necessarily regulate their eating on a schedule in the way that the Europeans did. And the Europeans were rather appalled and took this as evidence that the Native Americans were, in fact, uncivilized. Yet, I would argue that the way in which the early settlers and colonists were eating was not all that more civilized, in that, they would, you know, eat a sort of a parade of rather unbalanced meals during the day, and some of their meals were very spontaneous, and so they had their main meal in the middle of the day rather than the evening, and it was the one hot meal of the day. They may have heated breakfast or dinner, but often, breakfast or supper, but often those were cold meals. They were leftovers, cornmeal mush, this kind of thing. And these meals were not particularly social events.
Well, you said they didn't, by and large, they might not have even had a table or chairs.
That's right. A lot of households, you know, simply put a board across two trestles. They might have had a bench, which they called a form, and they often only put it on one side of the table rather than the sort of iconic dinner table we think of as the family seated around a
right.
table. They, you know, often ate with their hands, or they might just have a knife. They would sop up their, you know, food with their bread as kind of a spoon substitute. And they didn't have to catch up with each other, like we tend to think of the dinner meal as facilitating, because they were often working together all day anyways, you know, on farmsteads and whatnot. And so really eating was, dinner was much more sort of the business of eating. It was about refueling, and not a lot was invested in it socially.
Mm. So, I mean, it was really basically a means to get their sustenance and little else, and they dispensed with it quickly, I would imagine.
For the majority of people,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you give very nice references of actual writings, and particularly Alexander Hamilton. I was, you know, interested to see that he actually noted the dinner patterns and the eating patterns, and that was to me, at least, you know, it really illustrated what was going on at that time. Well, what, you know, we go over the next couple hundred years. What happened that formed our meal pattern as we know it?
Well, by the early to mid 1700s, the colonists were prospering more. They were looking to England for their fashion cues, and they were trying to, I think, move away from the peasant eating patterns, you know, that they had embraced and depended on. And of course, the ideal British, you know, upper class meal was a roast, and it was beef. And so, you know, the roast becomes iconic, surrounded by vegetables, which are now served on their own rather than mixed into a stew. And puddings and pies become quite popular. Often a meal started with a pudding and then proceeded to a roast, although there was really no emphasis on courses that came later. So that's sort of the typical meal for much of the country, or at least the typical ideal meal.
And would have primarily been in the middle of the day, too, right? That would have been the
yes, it would yeah. have remained in the middle of the day, and I think it was very much an expression of English identity, that they were identifying with England, and of prosperity, that they were able to, you know, have meat at the center of the meal rather than just a flavor for the stew or a glass. But then during the Industrial Revolution, that model was replaced by a model of courses in the French style. So you have also, and perhaps most importantly, during the Industrial Revolution, dinner shifts from the middle of the day to the evening. As people leave the farm and sort of embrace city life and work in factories, and more people are also working at desks, and it's not feasible for people to go home for a hot meal in the middle of the day. And so dinner shifts to the evening. It accommodates work patterns. And it becomes the time now when family is together. They've been separated throughout the day. They've all gone in different directions. And their evening is special because it's the only time during the weekday that they're together. And so dinner, by extension, becomes special.
Right. Well, and you mentioned that this, of course, came about with the Industrial Revolution. And prior to that, when we go back to the colonists' day, I mean, getting a meal on the table, cooking something, having hot food, that was no easy task. I mean, that took, you know, that took a lot of, a large part of their day.
Absolutely.
I mean, the open hearth cooking. And so with the Industrial Revolution, obviously there were more modern means of actually preparing food too, which made it possible, right, to cook mm-hmm. in the evening.
Yeah, and well, I think the other part of the puzzle is that servants come into play in a new way as the middle class emerges. It becomes typical of the middle class to have a servant or two, and of course, cooking is a big part of the servant's expected duties, and that's what makes it possible to have suddenly not only you know dinner in the evening, but more importantly, I think the French. Sequence of courses, you know, you're we think of starting with a salad. They would have started with a soup more typically, an entree, maybe a salad after the entree and dessert. And that separation of sweetness and savory really comes from the French during this time with a separate dessert course. And so you have not only now the specialization of foods like, in terms of separate, portions for you know, separate foodstuffs. Now you have a separation in terms of the time as well. You have a scattering of foods over a particular period of time for the meal.
Mm. Well, you talked about the cooking and servants come into play, but then we kind of you know fast forward a little bit and we're still sticking to basically three. They have established three meals a day. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. During that time,
yep.
The 1800s, right? What you know? Did anything change about housekeeping in terms of cooking that made it more respectable? I'm thinking more about the snacking. Actually, yeah, snacking was not sitting down to a meal and just snacking. That was not particularly looked upon as a proper meal, and it was. What you had mentioned that it was looked upon as being lower class.
Mm-hmm.
How did that change?
So snacking really comes into focus with the emergence of the modern evening meal, and it becomes taboo specifically because the meal becomes sacred. As the meal becomes a special time, sort of eating between meals becomes a threat to the meal. And because the evening meal was so much more than about the food that was served, it was about family, it was about middle-class propriety, it's where children were taught their manners, which was very important during this era. Snacking undermines all of that, and so, you know, it's looked down upon. It's seen as morally weak. It's also seen as unhealthy, and but it takes on even more stigmas as you start to have peddlers selling street foods. Snacks such as peanuts and popcorn are now associated with spaces of working class entertainment, sports, vaudeville theaters. Fairs, this kind of thing, and so for quite some time, snacking is really suspect. But that changes with commercialization, beginning in the very late 1800s, and basically packaging comes into play, and snack food is now available at grocery stores. It's not seen as hygienically questionable because you're not buying sort of the pretzel that's been exposed to the dust of the street, including the manure dust and whatnot from the days of horses and carriage. And then, of course, you know, sort of jumping to the mid-20th century with the invention of the television, snacking becomes domesticated. It's something you do at home in front of your television. And it also becomes incorporated into the meal itself.
Oh, yeah.
You know, snack food manufacturers are coming up with recipes so that you can, you know, use their pretzels in your pie crust.
Well, you talked about how our dinner patterns could have taken a different path.
Mm-hmm.
What, and this was perhaps cooperative housekeeping. What? Mm-hmm. Tell me about that a little bit. What do you mean about that?
Well, in the late 1800s, when there was what they referred to as the servant problem, servants were becoming less affordable, less reliable, and less available. Something, you know, had to be done. And so the home economics movement emerges as a way to sort of professionalize the career of servants and to train them and make them more reliable. But the problem was that there weren't very many candidates for the cooking classes and housekeeping classes that they were offering. And so the home economics movement ends up basically training the homemaker in going back into the kitchen and sort of relearning or cooking and cleaning and doing the things that their servants had done. But for some women, this was just really unstomachable. And so they pioneered, beginning in the 1860s, but this was most common in the between about 1900 and World War One, a movement called the Cooperative Housekeeping Movement, which was written up in women's magazines, and people would have known about it. And that was basically an alternative to women cooking in kitchens. It was basically you could pay your dues to a cooperative housekeeping club, and those dues would then in turn be used to pay for a cook, the rental of a space. People would bring their, you know, tablecloths, their china, and they would basically have a community meal, often, you know, as family units, not sort of Shaker style. But this was an alternative. Basically, this made the idea of the kitchenless house a possibility. Hmm. And actually, architects were, you know, designing these things. Novelists were writing about them. And there were even, contests in women's magazines for proposals for, cooperative housekeeping. Another model of cooperative housekeeping was the dinner delivery system, where you would actually eat dinner in your own house, but it would be delivered. But I think that I think this is very instructive when we think about this, because it does show a kind of fork in the road at one point, where dinner could have gone in a very different direction than it did go in. But the cooperative housekeeping movement ultimately failed.
That's very interesting. I actually had not read a lot about the cooperative housekeeping. The home economics movement had a lot of different avenues too. And of course, in the early 19th century with Juliette Corson, I mean, that was pretty much to help teach people about nutrition and how to cook. But this cooperative housekeeping is very interesting. That could be something that comes around again. Who knows? Sort of like people living on in cooperative farms and mm-hmm. eating together. It's not unlike that in large part, mm-hmm. I can imagine.
It does go against the grain of individualism, I think, though. That is
family unit, yeah.
Yes, and it's around, this time, I think, also when dinner has not only become special, but it's becoming a symbol of what it means to be American. And so, to have a cooperative housekeeping setting can be, it goes against the grain of a lot of what has been associated with American culture.
Right. Well, and so much of the American meal, as you've described too, revolves around, as you say, eating with the family unit.
Yes.
And so then there are all those workers who, don't have a family, for whatever reason, traveling. Okay. Boarding houses did come around, and meals were taken, since there were not restaurants at that time, but meals were taken at boarding houses.
Mm-hmm.
That was a communal meal all the same. So that became mm-hmm. their family. I mean, family, however you want to interpret it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll kind of talk about the modern meal and what's happening to that. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
It's when the nights get warm, and there's something sweet that I crave.
You are listening to California Peach by the California Honey Drops here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Really tastes the same. I'm talking about a sweet, 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 sweet Carolina peach. I want my Carolina peach. I got oranges all
week. Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past here at Heritage Radio Network, and I'm speaking with Abigail Carroll, the author of a new book called Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And Abigail, you mentioned how when the meal became an established practice, that it almost became sacred. I mean, that eating with the family was very, very important. And it's funny because suddenly in our new culture, food has taken on a religion again. It's like, you know, everyone is so obsessed with, you know, posting things on Twitter and on Facebook, and yeah, every meal they eat and every recipe that they prepare. But, you know, I don't know whether it's we feel guilty when we don't sit down and have a meal together. I think we do in a certain way, but our eating habits have never really been stable. Recently, and mm-hmm. eating patterns do change, but I think we're still trying to adhere to the family meal. Absolutely. What do you think is the future of our family meal?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a hard question to answer. Part of it has to do with what we decide we want, you know, for it to be as individuals and a society, and I'm not sure that we've, you know, have a lot of consensus about that. But what I do see in terms of pattern is that when I talk to people about my book, and I just, when I was writing it and I would say, oh, I'm writing a book about the history of the American meal, that's all I needed to say, people would start confessing that their families didn't eat together, or they tried, but they weren't able to keep it up, or this and that. And I was really taken back at first by how quickly and readily people sort of confess this about their personal, you know, lives. But I think it's a kind of expressive of a desire to have that conversation. You know, we're talking about food in our society perhaps more than ever. You know, we have the conversation going about organic food versus conventional, and we have the conversation going about local food and, you know, gourmet and all of these food trends. But I don't see people talking about how we eat. It's more about what we eat,
right,
or the social justice context of food and whatnot. But not so much about the family meal and the value of that, and also what the implications are for society, you know, of having regular meals. I think people's lament of its decline speaks not only to the fact that, you know, that it's been valuable in the past, but that it does have value, and they're right, I think, in thinking that the meal has value, because, you know, researchers have found a lot of interesting things about family dinner. You know, they found that when we eat together as opposed to eating alone, we always eat better nutritionally speaking. We always take in more vegetables and less saturated fat, less sugary drinks. Children who grow up eating regularly with their families tend to maintain these nutritional patterns into their young adult years. And they also are less likely to develop eating disorders, to abuse alcohol. Children's word banks grow faster when they're eating meals regularly with their family than the children who are not eating meals regularly with their family. So there is a lot of value. There's a reason, I think, that people regret the decline of the family meal.
So all of that, all those reprimands I gave to my kids, it all paid off in the end, we hope. Oh, you talked about the packaging sanitization, if you will, of snack foods, and they mm-hmm. became more acceptable. But then that also played into breakfast cereals. Breakfast foods, and how mm-hmm. breakfast actually evolved with particular foods. You know, rather than just eating the leftovers from the roast the night before, mm-hmm. the hot mm-hmm. meal, that breakfast evolved in a particular meal of its own. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, you know, like you mentioned, people did tend to eat leftovers for breakfast. There weren't specific foods that people ate only at breakfast in the colonial era and the pre-industrial era. In the late 17 and mid-1800s, people were basically eating dinner for breakfast. By then, they were having meats for breakfast, sometimes multiple meats, fish, all sorts of, you know, starches as well. But it was with the industrial revolution and the sort of the major changes that took place in society, the urbanization of society as well, that people were suffering a national case of indigestion because they were eating a farmer's diet, but they were, you know, living a more modern, urban, and a little bit more sedentary lifestyle. And the health reformers of this age looked to breakfast as, you know, a cure for that. And they experimented with what they called Graham flour, which was basically whole wheat flour, named after Sylvester Graham, who advocated homemade bread with the bran in it. And their experiments resulted in the invention of breakfast cereal. So breakfast cereal, thanks not only to the work of health reformers, but to the work of entrepreneurs, such as William Keith Kellogg, who was also the first person really to add sugar to breakfast cereals, to the consternation of his brother, Harvey Kellogg, who was really the inventor of cornflakes. So breakfast cereal and other similar farinaceous foods, grain-based foods, become very important to breakfast, but so does milk, so does orange juice, so does toast. Milk and orange juice, the story there really has to do with the discovery of vitamins in the 1910s. And, you know, they discovered that if you drank milk, it didn't really matter how poor your diet was, you weren't going to get the deficiency diseases that, you know, might be associated with a poor diet. And so it was hailed as a miracle food, and people didn't know how much you needed to drink to get the vitamin A, which it was eventually isolated as, from it. And so they just drank large quantities, and it worked well that it softened the breakfast cereal that was originally quite hard. And that was a sort of modern commercialized version of cornmeal mush, which was cornmeal and milk, or maybe milk and molasses.
So everything went back around again where we were back at the beginning. Well, if any one meal probably needs work on it today, I would say that it's probably breakfast. That, you know, people need to slow down and take more time to eat that first meal in the day.
Well, it accommodates our working lifestyle.
Another image that you portrayed so well is our, you know, our quick grab a bite for lunch kind of, you know, being an industrious society, you know, work, and in fact, there was just an article the other day, I think in the paper, those who eat at their desk and take only 20 minutes for lunch are more productive than those who actually take the time for an hour and go out and have lunch with friends. And it's like telling people they should sit at your desk and don't eat much. But the grabbing the sandwich, the automat, that was I was thinking of, the, you know, you know, the image of the automat, people, you know, grabbing something out of a, you know, pre-made meal out of a machine. But yeah, it definitely is because of work patterns, right?
I would definitely agree with you, yes. Breakfast and lunch, more so than dinner, but dinner to a certain extent, really reflects our prioritizing of work and also the influence of business culture. As food becomes commercialized, commercial foods colonize those meals, and I think they colonize breakfast more than any meal. You have foods that are designed to eaten quickly. They don't require cooking. They don't require cleanup. They often don't require utensils. And then dinner, of course, accommodates our work by sort of doing the opposite. It becomes this refuge from work and from the commercial world. And I think the ideal of having a homemade, you know, meal there makes it possible to not care about breakfast and lunch not being, you know, homemade foods, and especially breakfast.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, you mentioned restaurants. The restaurant culture plays really big into the whole family meal thing too. I mean, people take so many meals out. Well, the business meal, you know, that mm-hmm. so dinners, family dinners might have been replaced by, you know, taking the client out to dinner at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's still a meal that didn't exist centuries ago in terms of sitting, you know, with plate, fork, knife.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they had a knife, you were lucky, right, in the old days. But now we have, you know, all the implements and all the tools. We just need the time to sit down and have a nice dinner with her. It doesn't have to be homemade. You can get it ordered in, but sit down and set the table and have a nice meal with your family. I think that that is, I think it's a wonderful practice that started in, particularly in America. And I, for one, would like to see it continue. And, and I thank you so much for writing all this information in the book. It was really something I hadn't thought about, that meals weren't as we know it today. And, again, the book is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal by Abigail Carroll. Abigail, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Pelaggio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.